This is a Momentum Media production.
Nerd alert! Property Nerds, the home for data-driven property investors, where we uncover Australia's hot and cold markets, latest headlines and trends.
G'day everyone, it's Arjun Paliwal here, your co-host of the Property Nerds podcast, and welcome to another episode. And today we'll be talking about overvalued and undervalued markets alongside a bit of a finance update just to see where the trends have been heading. As we all know, the importance of finance and where it goes leads to where property eventually goes in many cases. But before we do that, I just wanted to remind you that the information we're going to cover off in today's podcast episode is totally free and able for you to download so you can visually follow along, so you can actually read and visualize the insights. And these white papers are something we do every single month, from whether it be fundamentals on housing, overvalue and undervalue index like today, or, you know, five economic regions that we think are standing out, or 10 economic powerhouses, top regions in certain states, and the list continues. We, in the research team here at InvestiKit, we produce all of these insights for you to be able to benefit, make the best decisions you can on your journey, be as informed as possible on the research around Australian housing markets, and go deep into these various topics. So just wanted to remind you, because sometimes, as you know, when you're on these podcasts, they're a great opportunity to learn, they're a great opportunity to tune into what's happening, but the audio, the visuals, the video in this case as well, can be different in terms of how you interpret that information and data. So why not get that report in front of you? Why not rewind this episode and go, hey, I'm going to have this report in front of me so I can really learn, or I can take out the insights I want to. Get this for free as well so you can actually figure out more about these insights in detail and just explore it as much as your heart desires. There's no cost at all. As I mentioned, it's investikit.com.au. And that is the white paper section or property research section on our website. This is just one of the research papers we're going through. As you know, in this episode, we'll be covering it deep, but this is something we do regularly across our episodes. We go through these research papers in great detail to offer you all an opportunity to understand property market research to a greater level. Hence, we are the Property Nerds. So just wanted to give you that quick shout out to remind you, investorkit.com.au, where you can check it out and you can go and download the research paper Overvalued or Undervalued for 2024, which is the topic we'll be going through in great detail today. So I've also got a fellow co-host with me, the lovely and beautiful Lee Paliwal. Lee, how are you?
Very well. Recording from a separate room in the same house. And yeah, ready to go through and dissect this report.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Before we get into it, Lee, I know on the finance world, there's been some trends emerging there with a recovery on some of the finance trends. Before we go into the report for today, I'd love to hand it over to you just to talk more about some of the finance trends you're seeing in the latest data release.
Yeah, so the ABS lending indicators were released for January 2024. And as you guys will know from following ABS data, is generally, well, it's 2 months behind. So it's good to see how that's in line with where we're actually at or going towards today. So in terms of housing finance lending indicators, the total housing for January 24 fell by 3.9% to 25.1 billion. And that's after a fall of 4.1%. in December, and this is actually 8.5% higher compared to a year ago. So whilst it's fallen, we are seeing higher numbers than 12 months ago. And in terms of the breakdown of that, for owner-occupier housing, that fell by 4.6% to 15.9 billion, and that's 3.4% higher compared to a year ago. And for investor housing, that fell by 2.6% to 9.2 billion, and that's 18.5% higher compared to 12 months ago.
Investors.
So investors are coming on in.
Yeah, they are truly, truly back. You know, so investor finance, this is big. And there's actually a recent article released a couple of months ago. We talked about this trend coming out. And what happens, everyone, is that investors are coming back because they envision something getting better, or they're envisioning something not being as bad as they thought. Maybe that second part's not envisioned. It's more like the first part. They envisioned something getting better, or they felt that something wasn't as bad as they thought. It's the commentary we're seeing here at InvestorKit as well, which is investors going, hey, I don't think those interest rate hits that we're going to make this market collapse and bring all the deals everywhere, they aren't as bad as they thought. So why am I not getting in the game? I'm on the sidelines. That was the first component we recognized. And then the second part is people who are anticipating lower interest rates are thinking, well, why don't I get involved? Yields are rising in some markets. Rents are still strong. Rental markets are growing. Vacancies low. And look, it wasn't as bad as I thought. Interest rates are probably going to get better. So I want to time it in. So there's a clear thought there that's happening across investors. And that's a big part of the activity. So that's pretty big there on the finance part, Lee, in terms of investors coming back and overall strengthening, even though technically, again, we haven't had interest rates drop. We talked about this in the last episode. What else are you seeing on the finance side?
So external refinancing for January 24 numbers. So total housing fell to 5%, down to 16.1 billion. So that's 19.5% lower compared to 12 months ago. Obviously, we've had the drop off of a lot of cashbacks for refinancing, obviously increase of interest rates, and obviously, you know, fixed rates and all that, they have come off. Rates are much higher than before. So from that, owner-occupier housing fell 7.4% to 10.3 billion. And that was 24.3% lower compared to it a year ago. And then investor housing fell only 0.5% to 5.8 billion. And that was 9.1% lower compared to 12 months ago. So that's from a higher level of what's happening. And like I said, there's 5 to 6 lenders roughly doing cashbacks only compared to, we're talking about 20 plus lenders back then doing refinance cashbacks and multiple refinance cashbacks, interest rate increases. And yeah, I guess like everyone coming off their fixed rates are really just starting to happen more over the last, I would say, 6 months anyways.
Yeah, what I noticed as well, Lee, is that I think refinancing maybe the last year ago was very high also because when I think interest rates start rising, that's also a time where people are looking at their options a bit more proactively than today. I think in that time, some time ago, they would have been thinking, hey, interest rates have risen a fair bit. I'm still, you know, not in a good bank. Could now be the time where I wasn't proactive and I should be. And that's where a lot of those trends might have been higher last year versus this year for refinances alongside the cashbacks for sure. It was a similar trend when COVID first hit. Remember when COVID first hit, the big refinance boom started where people were moving their mortgages, getting the best rates, being proactive, getting some equity out. In most cases, Australians' households are not actually very proactive on their finances. And then it's only when crisis hits, COVID, interest rates rising, where people go, oh, I better do something about it. And that's pretty normal in money management, but not the best way you should operate. So yeah, definitely some interesting stuff on the refinancing stuff there. What about in terms of just interest rates in general, Lee, that you're seeing?
Yeah. So firstly, like in terms of interest rates, obviously we're at today after the most recent cash rate increase. And there's a lot of talks of, you know, some hopes of some cash rate cuts coming in sooner rather than later for the cash RBA cash rate. And yeah, essentially it looks as though that the RBA will be holding the fort for some time with the 4.35% cash rate, maybe until maybe the second half year onwards of this year. Hopefully there will be some cash rate cuts coming through. In terms of actual interest rates, so I'm going to go through around, I guess, where rates should be sitting around roughly at the moment and give you guys as a listener an understanding of whether your rates are in a line with where they could be at the moment, depending on your type of loan or loan-to-value ratio that you have.
Yeah, that's helpful. That'd be good to know, actually.
Yeah. So essentially, best possible rates for, and again, this is it varies depending on the loan-to-value ratio and all that, but let's talk about 80% LVR for owner-occupiers on a P&I rate. You really should be early 6%, maybe even lower, again, depending on your total aggregate lending that you may have. Again, that's subject to change depending on your position, but you really should be around the early 6% for your owner-occ in current interest rate market. If you are borrowing over 80% up to 90%, also on your owner-occupied property PNI, that would be the early to mid 6%. So when I say early, probably like we're talking about 6.3 to 6.5% PNI rates. Investors, obviously a lot of our listeners are investors. So if you are 80% PNI, early sixes are around 6.3%. If you're 90% PNI investor, just over mid 6%. And again, interest only, which is obviously, you know, really important to maximize your cash flow as an investor. If you're on an interest only rate, then essentially we're looking around just over the mid sixes to late sixes. So anywhere around 6.5% to maybe 6.9% to 7%. Roughly, depending on your total aggregate lending. So that's kind of ballpark where your rates could be achievable at the moment. Now, obviously, again, depends on your certain scenario and overall total aggregate lending. If that's something that you need to review and you're not, you're way out of the ballpark that I just mentioned, then the best way to have a discussion and look into that is getting in contact with your mortgage broker. If you do not have a mortgage broker contact, you can reach out to my team at Hills Finance. The best way to do that is hillsfinance.com.au/contact and fill out your information. We'll jump on a call with you. So that's one thing. The other thing is obviously as rates continue to increase, generally your borrowing capacity will decrease, as we are all aware, as per many episodes that we've covered off. And so I would like to put out there a policy that we're best utilizing that could be, you know, of use for a lot of people, especially for applicants or borrowers who have additional incomes above base wage. So something that we've been utilizing a lot of late is a lender, a major bank lender, that essentially, instead of looking at 12 months year to date for, say, commission type income, there is a lender that will look at 3 months year to date. And what that means is, and how this is so useful, is in two ways. One, that you've only just recently started receiving commission income in the last 3 months, or your commission income has increased exponentially over the last 3 months. And this will then obviously bump up the income use from a serviceability point of view, from the bank's point of view, then therefore increase your borrowing capacity. So this is a big policy that we've been using a lot of late. And that's because of the additional incomes that people, whether from a household living perspective or how people are looking to increase their incomes through these additional earnings, we've been able to utilize that even for a shorter period of 3 months using that policy. So again, that's something that we've been utilizing to get that higher purchase potential.
That's hugely, because I think with that extra capacity, it's showing like banks being more tailored to the specific scenario. Because the reason why I say that is that, isn't it funny how they're more tailored on that front, but they're less tailored when they go, oh, look, you're an investor, let's just charge you more interest rates. Or you're an owner-occupier, we'll charge you less. And I think that would be a great dynamic if any of the bankers are listening to this one, that, you know, why do we penalize someone for wanting to build wealth, reduce the amount of aged pensions or income pensions going around in the future and the reliance on that, and providing a rental property to the Australian market during a rental crisis? Like, they're literally money that you're choosing to give out in the same way you're giving out for owner-occupier finance. You get the same security, a house and a house, yet, and with one, you receive a rental income and the other, you don't. You know what I mean? So therefore, it could be easier to pay for that investment. But now all of a sudden, it's like, oh no, we'll charge you more rates. That was something interested as well, right? So
yeah.
I think from that perspective, that was something I just noticed as a thought, like, hey, yes, you gave it these interest rates, but why are they separate like that? It's just something silly they need to look at.
Yeah, it's just something we've had to accept over the last 5 years, I guess, and make best use of your broker, I guess, and the policies.
Absolutely. So Lee, thank you so much for that update on finance. Shall we jump into this research paper, Overvalued, Undervalued for 2024?
Yes, let's do it. Before we dive into it, you might want to follow along during this podcast, or you might want to rewind and have another time to listen in. Again, to find this white paper we're going to go through, you need to check out investorkit.com.au/white paper, and you'll find all the free content. So today, Overvalued and Undervalued 2024. So first and foremost, so I can see here, so you've got 8 capital cities and 25 most populated regional cities that you covered off in the report. So Arjun, what criteria were used to select the cities including in the study, and why were these specific areas chosen?
Yeah, good question. So from the cities is just to get enough depth, but without going overkill. So for example, I found like population-wise, when you get to sort of the 25 non-capital cities, you get enough really, really good sample size and you get enough depth of an area to look across the nation. You could technically go up to like, say, 40 to 50 cities in total across the nation and still get enough population depth, data, trends, analysis, and so forth. But I felt like to combine it with like a combination of depth of population and choice, diversity across the nation, larger cities, smaller cities, and then from there be able to get enough data that we felt really confident about making this research. These kind of make sense, the 8 and the 25, which is still a good, you know, 33 regions, which is really healthy. And it's only about that 40 to 50 regions each year where you start to get to that cutoff of data. But this 30 plus regions is pretty healthy.
Okay, cool. And so I guess, like, what was the actual calculational method used?
Yeah, that's a good one. So I think when looking at the words overvalue, undervalue, sometimes people can use this data and like make it feel really scary. What I mean by that is imagine you hear someone saying your house is overvalued. It's not, right? At an individual house decision, you cannot like say your house is overvalued because there are multiple things that determine value. Number one is that someone is able to afford a mortgage to buy it or place the money down, then have a smaller mortgage to buy it, right? Number two is that when you're looking at it, there is a market. So the market is many other owner occupiers, which are the majority of housing, and they're all coming together to make a bid. So there's a market that values it there. And then off the back of that, number three is that people are not just paying the same amount. People are paying more and more as time's gone on. So therefore it's a rising market. So it's rising value. So you can't just say that, hey, you saw your city here, therefore it was a bad decision, a bad one to buy, and now overvalued. There are rough metrics that we use, but remember, rough metrics that are used cannot be like describing every household situation. For example, someone could purchase with cash, someone could purchase with the 80% loan and 90% loan, cross-secure homes or take out equity and make it 100% plus cost. Someone could take out a 20% loan and just have the rest covered in cash or money sitting in their offset. So by no means should people take this research and go, oh no, the city's overvalued, bad decision. It's essentially just going and trying to look at housing in a different way. All of housing values and people's determination of whether markets are expensive or not had just been driven by the purchase price, price to income ratios. And I don't think they're very, you know, important ratios to look at in isolation. I found what's more important is people's ability to make repayments. And so what we did in this methodology was we used this combination of a household's income. We took that broad statement of affordability that's used often in global indexes of 30 to 33% of that household's income going towards repayment. And then we took a typical loan scenario, 30 years, 80% loan to value ratio, principal and interest, and got interest rates at 6.5% and 5.5% because they've been hovering there in the lending criteria between these two numbers. So by doing this and having repayments with a loan that is based on those scenarios against the median price of a city, and then putting it against incomes for a city at a household level with that 30 to 33% of their income going towards mortgages, you can essentially say, well, the median price in the city needs to come back by 10% to get it to fair value, which is that number of income and number of the repayments that I described before is matching to those thresholds. And that would be deemed as overvalued by 10%. Or a city's undervalued by 10%, as an example, because prices would have to rise, loan sizes and repayments would have to rise for them to meet those 30 to 33% of incomes for a household. So it's just showing the local income's strengths against repayments. Remember, there are different loan sizes, different house sizes, different income sizes. So it's not as easy as blanket approaching it. But in data, when modeling things, you have to blanket approach to some extent. And it's around finding cities that are undervalued, which when you pair them with many other metrics to say there's undersupply, strong economies, strong rental markets, and undervalue, cha-ching. It's usually a great scenario for many things to come together. And I've got working examples. The same on the opposite. Oversupply of house, oversupply of rentals, oversupply construction, low and or weakening economy, and then an overvalue of housing. It's just not an attraction in terms of everything coming together. I have many examples where house values have risen, even in overvalued markets, because remember I told you, you can't use one metric to describe everything, but it's just placing a different lens on how to look at markets. And then you can use this data alongside many other data pieces just to have a bit more comfort with it. And the good thing is this is edition two, Lee, not the first edition, which means we can look at last year's release, this year's release, and just see what some of the trends were that came up.
And it might be a silly question. Say I'm a brand new investor, first time investor, or quite new into my journey. So I'm going to dissect this report, and what do I take from this report? It's going to tell me where I should be buying, and I should be buying in the undervalue areas. Is that how you would interpret it as a new investor, or like what's the gem I'm looking for?
Good question. So I want to give you a couple of ways to look at this. Number one is you're analyzing a few housing markets and you're wanting to see if it is having a close to value or undervalue that further supports your analysis to go, not only do I like the city for ABC reasons, but on top of that, it's undervalued and has potential with local incomes and affordability using this one way of measuring it. So that could be one way of using it, right?
Yeah.
Another way of using it could be going, hey, well, this market is a little bit overvalued. Well, in doing that, am I looking at finding any other signs across the markets analytics that are also saying that it's not so healthy? Or if you're looking at it and it's overvalued and markets have risen in recent times, which I've got examples of, you can essentially go, well, what are some of the trends driving this rise that are forcing it to rise, even though local conditions for local median or average incomes, right? So it's not like everyone is making this headwind still, you know, not be that impactful. The headwind isn't so impactful with overvalue, and yet prices are growing. It just makes you look deeper. So the key is it'll support your analysis if undervalued and you found a city you like for many other reasons. Or if you're overvalued and markets are likely to grow with other signals, what's making it really push the headwinds aside? And how can you look into that deeper to feel more rounded in your analysis? Or if it's going backwards and it's overvalued, and what can you see that could be some signs that is that going to change or not? And so it's about using this to support your analysis and realizing that local affordability trends can play a mark, but one metric alone will not show affordability. It's just one important part of it. And I can give you an example as well, Lee. So to give you an example, I'll show you something that was really interesting. Bundaberg, as an example here, in the report, had a median house price change of 10.4% for the city. So double-digit growth amongst these regions, which is quite rare, by the way. It wasn't everywhere to be found. And so if you're looking at double-digit house price growth, phenomenal. And interestingly enough, in the last edition that we did of this report, Bundaberg was 18% undervalued on 5.5% interest rates and 6% undervalued at 6.5% interest rates. Today, it's still 14% undervalued at 5.5% interest rates and 2% undervalued at 6.5% interest rates. So it's still undervalued, and it has been. And by the way, it happened to also grow. Not saying it's an isolated correlated metric, but it's a supporting metric that aids the growth journey if many other pieces are strong as well. And let me flip this on the opposite. If we look at some declines, one of the highest overvalued markets was the Byron Bay region, Richmond Valley Coastal. So Byron Bay, surrounding regions around there. The SA3, so this is just statistical area level 3, used in census ABS stats, just to cluster together multiple regions to create a bigger population set. That region actually had a decline of 15.7% in prices. It was also one of the most overvalued regions with a 60% overvalue at the last research report, and then 45% overvalue at this research report release with the 5.5% interest rates. On the 6.5% interest rates, that was 64% overvalue. Now it's come down to 51%. So you can see that it was the most overvalued, And it also happened to have the most declines. Now, I'm not going to rule it too overvalued, but I'm definitely going to say that alongside those weak trends, overvalued just made it weaker. And so this is just an example of showing you that some of the more resilient rising markets were actually majority undervalued. And many of the markets that didn't do so well, not all, were overvalued. And this two extremes of the opposites was one way to show it. Another one I can give you just to show the, again, two extremes is Rockhampton. Rockhampton had phenomenal growth with 10.4% over the last 12 months. It was also one of the most undervalued markets in the nation, with 62% undervalue at 5.5% interest rates in last research release. And in this research release, it still remains 57% undervalued at 5.5% and 41% undervalued at 6.5%. So go figure, the most undervalued region in the whole country in terms of regions in the nation are the ones that we've looked at here, the 25 major regional centers and the eight capitals. Happen to also be one of the top performers for price growth amongst them. And so that's the key thing to consider. You know, you've got capital cities as well. This is an example of where maybe that data isn't super, super helpful in isolation. I always look at it as a supporting metric. Perth grew based on this data set, which is using a mixture of domain data and ABS data. And we can see that he had 9.3% growth in the last 12 months at the time of producing this report. Perth has remained undervalued even today by 10% at 6.5% interest rates and 22% at 5.5%. Adelaide grew just as much as Perth did, but it was slightly overvalued at 10% and 19%, depending on the interest rates used this release. So you can just see here that it's such strength in these numbers when you add them as a supporting metric to your analysis. Obviously, this metric can be fought away if you're like Adelaide, where Adelaide had strong economy, undersupply of housing, undersupply for rent, undersupply in construction. Then from that perspective, if you put all those together, they just pushed against that headwind of overvalue. And also remembering that Adelaide is a region of many sub-regions, and this is produced at a greater city level, right? So all those incomes get mixed up as well. And so from that perspective, Lee, I thought that would be a good way to visualize that, hey, this report and the methodology is very powerful, and some examples that we saw as well.
Yeah, it sounds like an 8 to 9% variance to the current edition from last year's edition on average, like it's roughly. Is that a common variance over the last 12 months for most of the areas?
It depends. It's a good question. So not a common variance. Like I'll give you an example. Sydney's overvalue, undervalue variance was only 2% in the last release at 2022 end. Versus the 2024 beginning and release of this data. Why was it only 2%? Because there's multiple metrics that feed into this data. One is the incomes of local areas. So the incomes changing differently across areas. Number two is also the house prices. So if the incomes change and the house prices change, the formula changes. And so as a result, some areas had a greater change and it was massive. And then some areas had no variance because things moved, I guess, in line with each other, or one moved down, the other moved up enough to create a similar gap. And so I think it's about looking at this in full holistic details. And that's the beauty of this metric. It's not like price only. We're looking at the repayments and incomes all together. But yeah, that was really fascinating to see, right? And so I found that that was an improvement. So yeah, I think from that perspective, that gives you some insights just high level on this.
Does that correlate to what you guys are seeing on the ground, Investigate, around when you're buying? So obviously there's some areas that are coming in still quite undervalued. Are you seeing it a lot busier on the ground for buying in those areas currently? Or how does that correlate to your day-to-day?
Absolutely. So let's just say when we're looking on the ground, I'll give you a couple of locations there that we've seen. So Townsville, Toowoomba, Rockhampton are three regions here that are very undervalued. And they've been undervalued in the last release and in this release. Toowoomba a little bit less because it's picked up in price a little bit longer than those other two regions. And those three have been extremely busy on the ground, multiple offer situations, and vendors, buyers are just fighting over everything. Vendors saying, give me more. Buyers saying, okay, I will. So not much of a fight in that regard, but buyers are definitely fighting and getting prices to increase. So those are three examples where they're all undervalued by this index, both last year and this year. Another one that's really interesting is Bendigo, right? So Bendigo was overvalued by 11% in the last release ending 2022. at 5.5% interest rates, and it was overvalued by 20% at the 6.5% interest rate mark. But because the Bendigo prices cooled off a little bit, they did decline 4.2% in recent times. Now we've got the affordability as incomes have risen, but prices have cooled off, actually improved. So in a scenario where everyone's like, no, interest rates, or no, you know, prices are unaffordable, they're growing everywhere, not every city is going to see the same dynamic. Bendigo's actually gotten more affordable over the last release versus the release prior. In this release here, Bendigo is now undervalued at 10% at the 5.5% interest rate mark, and its fair value at 6.5% interest rate. So you could look at Bendigo right now and go, hold on a minute, it hasn't grown a lot. It's actually stepped back a little bit. And now the cycle is starting to show that it's not overvalued anymore. And if interest rates are heading the way they go, and all of a sudden Bendigo becomes 10 to 20% undervalued as interest rates come down from the sixes to the fives to even the fours potentially in the future. So that's an example of looking at it in multiple ways. Yes, the WAs, the Queenslands, and some parts of SA definitely are the most undervalued. But then when you go to shifts occurring, it's clear that Victoria is improving, because Melbourne, as an example, moved from 28% overvalued at 5.5 interest rates in the last release, has now improved to 18% overvalued. So that's a great improvement. Bendigo, I pointed out, went from 11% overvalued in the last release at 5.5% interest rates, now to 10% undervalued at 5.5% interest rates. Albury-Wodonga is shifting as well. So I think there's a clear trend that Victoria is starting to become a little bit more undervalued, or at least heading in that direction from more overvalued to less. But Queensland and WA seem to be the hot topics right now, especially with their undervalue that's being seen.
You've mentioned a couple times the average income for the area. As an investor going to buy in certain areas, I don't think that comes front of mind, is to think or check what is the average income for that area when you're buying a property, when that's one of your data sets that you're looking at, which I find quite interesting. And it sounds like even when you gave the Bendigo example, that has swayed it quite a bit with the average income going up.
Yeah.
So I just find that quite interesting. It's quite important to, I guess, check the average income or household income for those areas that you might be buying. And then,
yeah, what I'd more so say is that I would say like income is playing a part, but also the fact that it's income and house prices that are changing, right?
Yeah.
Everyone seems to make this big mistake that they see a house price boom on the media. They see it in the greater capital cities charts that they think house prices everywhere are booming. And therefore the opinion is that everywhere's booming.
Yeah.
Well, no, it hasn't been the case. Like Bendigo in recent times was not booming. It's going through what we call a second wind dynamic. A second wind dynamic is when a market comes back a little bit, yields start to rise, rents rise, prices are stable, incomes are rising, the local economy is still strong. And then all of a sudden supply starts to level out again. And then prices come back up for a second rush. And that's because the yields go attractive. Value is becoming more valued, as you can see here with this overvalue, undervalue index. So it's clear that some changes are happening there as well, just as an example of one of the markets.
Amazing. Well, clearly a lot of value there in that report. Any limitations of the report that, I guess, with the methodology that you guys are using, is there any limitations around that, you know, uncertainties are on this report that aren't being kept that you need to consider? Or
of course, it's a good point. So the big parts that need to be considered here is those major cities. When you're looking at those major cities, those incomes, like, wow, there's a big divergence, right? You could see some huge incomes in some part of town and then some not so big. But then what's going to happen is Greater Sydney, Greater Melbourne will just be treated as one huge data set. So not very helpful in those parts. The second part here is that you will also realize that money doesn't just flow in from local incomes. Money flows in from all over, right? So you might ask yourself, well, Arjun, how did Byron Bay and all these areas get so undervalued? Well, money's flowing in from all over. People might have holiday homes there. People might have investments there. People might not be there on the night that income data is collected, or whatever it may be. I'm just saying that money flows in from all angles, overseas, interstate, intrastate, and from local communities. So it's hard to just use income metrics and assume that that local income is everything that drives it. And then lastly, this is just one angle, right? People do not buy property with 80% loans on perfect terms, with 30-year loan terms at median prices everywhere across the nation. No, median is just the middle, and 80% is just a sample size used for a typical loan-to-value ratio. Some loan-to-value ratios can be 90. And PICSA recently released a report showing a huge volume of properties bought with cash over the last 12 months. So like this whole overvalued, like someone might be laughing at that going, huh, don't care if, you know, Brisbane's overvalued. I just bought this property cash by selling my Sydney one, moving over, and I'm now there. Or someone bought a cash property in the coastal parts of Harvey Bay and said, I just sold my Brisbane home, cash the extra, and I'm up here, bought it cash with maybe a 10% loan. So there's just so many dynamics that you have to get quite micro on. But as a supporting indicator, it's been one of my favorites so far. I just showed so many instances where I could pick up some really affordable markets. And guess what? Those affordable markets seem to be attractive a lot to both local buyers and interstate investors. Because if you line them up with some of the growth that's happening, we all know Queensland WASA is showing some real strength here. And Queensland WA seem to be having the most undervalued locations. Then people have been also questioning whether Melbourne's time's coming around. When will that Melbourne time look good because it hasn't grown so much? Well, you can see an undervalue starting to get closer and closer to being achieved because, you know, the incomes are rising, but prices aren't. And then that's changing. And then what about regional Victoria? It hasn't had its time in the sun and now it's starting to improve again. And all of a sudden, Bendigo's now undervalued. So you can use these trends really positively to support your overall analysis from seeing what's undervalued now and continuing to rocket away if supporting indicators are strong, and from seeing those that maybe slowed down a little but might have a second run again. And you can see that their indicators are improving on the overvalue, undervalue. So it's a brilliant supporting indicator, not the only indicator. And I've been, you know, always mindful of that for every report and analysis we do.
Lots of interesting insights again, Arjun. Is there any last final points that you wanted to cover off on that report?
Yeah, I think one of the favorite pages that you'll see in that report, which I'm positive many of you will love, is actually on the main summary page. It's page 10 of the report. And it's got this really cool graph. And I got to give a shout out to Jung in our research team. She's our senior research analyst and been with us since day one of the production of these research papers. So cannot give her any more of a shout out. She's just phenomenal. So I wanted to say that chart, you'll love that because when you check that out, that chart shows you just a bit of a scatter plot and the overvalued, undervalued, where certain cities are, what's standing out. You'll really enjoy that. It'll also show you the which ones moved in the directional shifts because we did this report in 22/23. And so then you can see where they were and then the ones in 2024. And the big call out here is, remember, it is not a single-sided equation of interest rates. Everyone keeps talking about that. What we should also look at is the booming wages. Now, of course, there's an argument on its own that inflation hasn't kept up, as in the other way around. Wages haven't kept up with inflation as well. But you cannot argue that they have not been booming. They have been booming. Wages are doing so well. Look at that index chart of wages. That is a big answer to the shift in undervalue, overvalue. And you can start to see that if wages went up in many areas, prices stabilized, and then interest rates are using that 5.5 and 6.5, what does that mean? A place will become less overvalued or more undervalued. And so there's multiple dynamics to the game. It isn't just interest rates alone. We have to look at all things holistically. Price movements, income movements, interest rates, pick them together as just a metric here coming for overvalue and undervalue. You'll enjoy that section of the report. It's page 10. Great summary showing a few things, where they were, where they are now, and some of the changes. And I'm confident if you check this out, you'll see some of the correlation impacts we've drawn out, some of the affordability upsides in certain cities, the changing affordability dynamics, as I pointed out today. And that's all free to download it at investorkit.com.au and our most recent white paper, Overvalued or Undervalued 2024.
And whilst interest rates aren't the only indicator, again, I mentioned some interest rates of where you should be sitting. So if you've got interest rates of 7.5 or higher, could be worth having a review of those. And you can do that by reaching out to obviously your mortgage broker. And if you do not have a contact, you can reach out to my team at Hills Finance, which is the best way is hillsfinance.com.au/contact.
The information featured in this podcast is general in nature and does not take into consideration your financial situation or individual needs and should not be relied upon. Before making any investment, insurance, tax, property or financial planning decision, you should consult a licensed professional who can advise whether your decision is appropriate for you. Guests appearing on this podcast may have a commercial relationship with the companies mentioned. Game over.